Hello, I'm Dusty Timmons with Conservation Stories, and I recently was afforded the opportunity to go to the Hunt Fish Podcast Summit held outside of Houston and interview a number of interesting people for the Conservation Stories that you'll be hearing over the next couple of weeks. Included in these are people from all walks of life that are involved in conservation and charitable organizations that I feel will be really interesting. I hope you enjoy the podcast as much as I enjoyed recording the interviews for you.
Irrigating with salty water is like trying to milk a longhorn cow. You won't get out what you put in. HSI water uses sulfurous acid to neutralize bicarbonates, lower soil pH, and flush salts from the root zone. Cleaner water, healthier soil, less buildup in your lines. Producers who get their irrigation water dialed in see better nutrient uptake, improved infiltration, and reduced fertilizer costs season after season. Getting your water right is one of the highest return investments on the farm. Our specialists will work with you to design the right system for your needs. No guesswork, just a clear picture of your water chemistry and a plan that fits your operation. So, is your water working for you or against you? Find out at hsiwater.com.
Text SALTY, that's S-A-L-T-Y, to 979-232-2528.
Good afternoon. We're here with Chuck Neisler?
Neiser.
Mm-hmm. There it is. Yeah, I don't have my glasses on, so I can't. He's regarded as one of the most accomplished and revered fly fishing guides in Texas. And that's what it says in your bio, so that's what I'm going to hold you to. But the work that Chuck's done a lot with the controlling the commercial fishing, reducing the commercial fishing, redfish and trout along the Gulf back in the days when the earlier pioneers of shutting that down, and his work with the what was called the Gulf Coast Conservation Association, which is now the CCA, and then it with the growing popularity of it, Chuck realized that something needed to be done with the problems that were magnified in the Gulf, and so he started it with, he founded the Flatsworthy Inc. in 2015. Chuck, a lot of people have told me that when I was talking about, okay, what is this, you know, I'm not a Gulf Coast guy, long ways away, and it's like, what is Chuck? So you've been described to me as, you know, like I said earlier, the godfather of the fly fishing on the coast, and the work that you've done leading conservationists for protecting the redfish and trout. Tell me a little bit about yourself and about where your story comes from in protecting the redfish.
Well, the good parts we don't have enough time for. Well, that was my training ground for what I'm doing today. Back in the 1970s, with several events that brought the popularity of redfish and trout, and especially redfish, to the forefront, the pressure put upon the fishery by the commercial harvest of trout and redfish through the advent of the ghost nets, which were monofilament nets that were just freestanding in the water. They had no floats, they had no nothing. I mean, people could go out and set these nets, and they were indiscriminate. They would catch whatever is there. And over time, you know, we started noticing that we could go to places that we would normally catch fish, and there were none. And that was coast-wise. So that was from South Padre, Galveston, Sabine Pass, you know, all up and down the coast, this phenomenon was going on. And so I went, I mean, everybody was grumbling to themselves and the conversations, you know, and we knew what was going on. We knew there was an enemy in this deal, and he was the commercial fisherman. And we knew how he was doing. I mean, we watched it. And so I went to a boat show, and I was fishing just in Rockport back then, and there's a million stories in this thing. I'm telling you, they're great stories that could never happen again. all of the cowboy and the Indian stuff that went on between netters and game wardens and us, and burning cabins and shooting guns, and I mean, it was a real deal. And I went to the Houston Boat Show, and it was in 1977. And I went there, and there was a group of men at the door, and they were hauling us in. We formed the Gulf Coast Conservation Association, and we want to stop the commercial activity on the netting of trout and redfish. Well, sign me up, you know. and so I got involved with that group. I was living in Brazoria County. They were in Houston, but I'm all in or I'm all out, and I was all in on that. So I got in with that group, and it was led by Walter Fondren and others who were really my mentors in what I'm doing today as far as how they went about approaching conservation and how you won on an issue. And so that battle went on. When I say we, I was really kind of a follower. I was probably member number 200 of the GCCA, which is now the CCA. I wasn't a founder, I'll clear that up, but I became very, very active in that, and formed the Brazoria County chapter, and I went up and down the coast starting chapters with the guys, and I've been involved with some oyster work that was kind of similar, but the stopping of the gill netting was ugly.
Yeah.
It was for real. And we were going into a group of men who had historically been involved in selling these fish. And we were stopping their livelihood, and they weren't real happy about it.
I can imagine not.
But you know, I think probably the thing that I learned the most was I thought our cause was so right and so righteous that anybody who was objective about this would agree with us. And I'm talking about legislators or, you know, whoever. And that wasn't the case. I'm going, how can this be? We're seeing a healthy fishery go to no fishery, and we know what the reason is, and they don't want to help us stop it. And I'm going like, this ain't right, you know? So I learned that even though your cause to you may be just, it doesn't mean you're going to attain it. That there are factors mm-hmm. that you need to look at that are standing in your way. And so you have to define those, you have to meet them head on, one by one by one, and you have to overcome that. And in the, you know, we started this in 1977, and we didn't get House Bill 1000 until 1981. And I'd have never thought it'd take 4 years to get anything like that.
Yeah.
That's 4 years.
Yeah.
You know, of your life shot to hell. You know? So, we had different things along the way that made a real difference. We had Perry R. Bass, who from Fort Worth and owns San Jose Island, was chairman of the Parks and Wildlife, and he got it. He understood. And when he came into this issue, he turned the tide for us. And then we had different legislators who stood up for us, and we had people, it just didn't make any sense, you mm-hmm. know. it's all about historical relationships that some of these people had with the legislators in their home districts, mm-hmm. and we couldn't unroot it. You know, it was an ugly fight. There's no doubt about that. But in the end, you know, everybody came around and passed House Bill 1000, and that's why people don't even know we did this.
Yeah.
People do not understand that at one point in time, there were more redfish in the restaurant than there was in the water. You know? Yeah. And so when you talk about that topic nowadays, nobody, it doesn't mean anything to them. You know, they assume that we have a fishery and there's going to be fish there and, you know, la-di-da-di-da.
Yeah.
But those fish came from somewhere, and they came from an effort back a good while ago to protect this resource. And then, you know, we've, of course, after that, we had several freezes, we've had algae blooms, we have different things that threaten the resource and hurt it. You know, I was speaking a little while ago, and I said, you know, Mother Nature is a beautiful lady. Mm-hmm. If you give her a chance, she will heal. But you gotta give her a chance.
Yep.
And so every threat that I've seen come her way, I've seen her overcome. The freeze of 83, the freeze of 89, red tide, brown tide, blue-green algae, you know, the freezes in the 90s, and we're still not over the freeze of 2021, not my way of thinking.
Yeah. So,
but it was a time I made a lot of friends. It was a time that I had people that I still deeply respect who gave of their time. They showed me the way for me to do it today. And I don't know what else to say about it.
As someone who has infrequently been able to fish for redfish, I appreciate your efforts.
Well, none of these things are ever a person.
Yeah.
It's a coalition of people.
Yes.
Like-minded individuals who came together. And I'd love to say I'm the guy that saved this place. I'm not.
No, but you're the guy that saved this place that I'm getting to talk to.
Yeah.
And so,
well, then let me tell you how cool I really
there
am.
There you go. That's what Well, the thing about it is that, you know, every movement, every change, every conservation effort that's led is, generally speaking, is a group of people. And maybe one of them may not be greater than the other, but all of them should be respected. And the work that you've done in protecting the fishery deserves to be recognized. And I'm not saying that you're the only one. I'm not saying that you're the head guy, but everybody's gone out there and stood in the line and took the slings and arrows for it deserves some props. And I really do appreciate, because, you know, I've done a little bit of research back as a kid. I was very, you know, I read everything. I still read a lot, but hunting and fishing magazines were my jam. I mean, I loved that. Loved to hunt. I loved to fish. Mm-hmm. But, you know, being from the South Plains of Texas, I'm not coastal, and so I didn't grow up coastal fishing, and did not get even to even get a taste of that until just the last 4 or 5 years. But I read the stories. I read about, you know, how tough it was and what the fisheries looked like back then. Back, you know, even, you know, I'm 51, I was born in 74, so this happened, you know, what, before I was paying a lot of attention to it, before I could pay attention to anything. I wasn't even messing a diaper when it started, probably.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is that building that baseline, when you build a base, a hedge against, you know, to protect a resource. You know, the people that put the foundation in that thing, everything you do from a conservation standpoint going forward from this goes back to that original Houston Boat Show meeting.
It does.
Where you met that, and it started there. You know, it's a flag that you can put in there. And you talked about the different things, challenges that are still facing redfish. Let's fast forward a little bit, and let's talk about the fishery today. You said it still hadn't recovered fully to the from the freeze of 21. What are the challenges that you see to the fishery at this point?
Well, there are some. Number one, man is a threat. You know, look, we can go into this thing and we can look at threats from natural occurrences or threats from man. We cannot do anything about storms, mm-hmm. drought, flood, any of those things. We can't.
Right.
We can only do something about man's influence, good or bad, on this resource. So we should focus on that. And that comes from improper using it with our accessing it with our boats and motors and tearing the resource up. It comes from over harvest of either fish or oysters in this case. The threat, when if you go into flatsworthy.com, mm-hmm. which is our website, and you look at, I have a video in there called Protecting the Resource. And I don't really remember what year that was made. But I made it with the University of Texas Marine Science Institute and Mission Ranzesner with Jace Tunnell and Katie Swanson. At that time, I thought the greatest threat to the health of the ecosystem, I mean, you have a fish and then you have a system mm-hmm. that it lives in. So to look at one without looking at the other is a mistake. So I thought the greatest threat to the ecosystem was the health of the vegetation. And so we made this video, which is really a good video, even if I made it myself. it's about 8 minutes long, but it tells a story about the decline. You know, you only start talking about issues when they are in decline. And so then I got involved in the oyster issue, which is where I am totally involved in today. And as I got into that, and I have a relationship that I'm proud of with all of the universities, all of the people of influence, all the NGOs, the state agencies, I feel like I can call and get an answer to anything I might be smart enough to ask. But as I got into that issue, I realized that I was wrong in stating that the most important aspect of the ecosystem was it's the oyster reef. And from that lowly creature laying on the bottom of the bay, everything else emanates. And so we got into, you go to the website, and I've got a video on there called The Tipping Point, and you look at that, and it will tell you what the story is. It will tell you in a factual, but it's a passionate one. I mean, we got some energy in it. As I got into that, I realized that the biggest single threat is the over-harvest of a natural resource that we had called the oyster reef, that had evolved over eons of time. If, you know, man didn't do anything to put it there, God did.
Mm-hmm.
And man was tearing it apart, and we've got video evidence of what was going on in that video. So that's my focus right now, is on that issue first.
Is that what started Flatsworthy?
No, what started Flatsworthy was bad behavior. And, you know, I watched. I've been in that arena for a long, long time. I mean, look at me. No, don't. So,
hey, you still got more hair than I do.
Well, you're right there. But so, I, you know, in the 90s and the up until about 2015, I was on the water every day. So I knew what the heck was going on. I watched it. I watched the behavior between user groups and bad behavior. Pardon me. And the total lack of fair chase and the unethical things that were going on. And so I came home and I said, I'm just going to gripe about this, or am I going to come out and say something? So I called 11 other people from different user groups. I said, we need to have a meeting. We had a meeting. We talked about it. Everybody said, yeah, we can't believe what's going on. And so I formed Flatsworthy from that. And we started off working with etiquette, you know, conflict mm-hmm. between kayakers, airboaters, poling skiff, you know, all of these issues right there. And we started trying to bring them together. It was kind of a kumbaya deal. I'm sorry. I need some of that. No. So that's what brought us together. And then we had public meetings and we talked about these things, and people hated me and people liked me and, you know, all of those things. But COVID came along and stopped the public meeting. We couldn't have them anymore. So mm-hmm. we go, you know, like 9 months. So during that time, I went out. I said, well, I'm not going to waste this time. I went and had meetings with all of these people in these institutions and built relationships and bonds. And then in 2016, what we witnessed as far as the total pillage of our oyster reefs by, I mean, just unbelievable pressure being put on the harvest on these reefs. And then from that, I knew what was going to happen as it translated into erosion and everything else. And I just said, I got to do something. And I did. Well, there you are.
So when you talk about the educate a West Texas boy on an oyster reef, and what's then, you know, drill out into the specifics of what's happening to them, what can we do to help bring that, to protect our oyster reefs?
Well, an oyster is a filter feeder, mm-hmm. number one. I mean, that's...
And tasty as all get out.
That's our...
And tasty as all get out.
Yeah, no, I love to eat them. And here I am talking about halting the, you know, the harvest. But, so it's a filter feeder, so as impurities are in your water, and dirt and suspend other particulates in there, it will filter that out and release clean water. Clean water is clear water. Clear water allows sunlight penetration. All right, so filtration. The structure of the reef itself, a reef has forms as the result of a process called cementing. Ring a bell?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So cementing is when you have two juvenile oysters and they grow and they secrete cement that binds them together to, over time, create a structure. Now, the structures don't just grow willy-nilly. They only grow on suitable substrate. So hence, every part of the bottom of a bay is not oyster.
Mm-hmm.
It is only where you have a suitable substrate for that oyster to initially attach. Over time, it grows up and it gives it vertical relief above the surrounding area. So you, in essence, create a structure that is a levee within a bay system.
Mm-hmm.
The levee and the angle of slope on that will attenuate wave force and energy. it will control the volume and velocity of movement through that arena. So with water clarity, with volume control, velocity control, wave attenuation, those functions right there serve to reduce the pressures of erosion.
Mm-hmm.
And they, by having clear water, you allow sunlight penetration, which is essential to all marine life. Even the oyster needs sunlight penetration. Plus, the structure of a reef is home to hundreds of organisms itself, from worms to crab to fish to whatever you can think of lives on that reef. That's a home,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to a bottom that is nothing but clay or mud. So I don't know what else to say about it. That's it in a nutshell, is that it is essential to the health of a system. You know, I think back and I go, when I first got here, this was the most beautiful place I'd ever seen. Rockport, I mean, mm-hmm. we're not there right now.
Yeah. I know what you're talking about though.
And man didn't create it. And then I see it change, and I see why it changes, and it tells me, I've kind of lost my train of thought here. It's been a long day.
It has been a long day. That's right. Yeah.
But the essence of this deal is that we have got to be responsible. We have to step up. We have to protect what we have, because we're at my video, the first one you're gonna see tonight, is called The Tipping Point. And you reach different points in time where if things continue, you have gone over reality and you cannot recover from it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, one of my sayings is the cheapest restoration project is not to need it in the first place.
Yes.
So if we stop some of this jackassery that's going on out here, we don't need to fix it because it's not going to be broke anymore.
Right.
We're at a point where if we stop, we can protect to the best of our abilities what we have now. And if we do not stop it now, in 10 years, it's not going to be here.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a, you know, what you talk about in terms of conservation is not a light switch deal. You don't walk over the wall, hit a switch, and a light comes on. It's cumulative over time. It's like corrosion, you know?
Yeah.
If left alone, it just eats away what you got. And so you have to be creative. You have to look at yesterday, today, and tomorrow. What was here 10 years ago? What's here today? And how does that differential translating what's going to be here in 10 years.
Right. When is the primary threat to the oyster reefs? Is it primarily overfishing, or is it some other thing, something else that we're doing?
The primary threat to the structural integrity via vertical relief is dredging the oyster reef, because that's what it is. I mean, it's no different than a dragline bucket.
Yeah.
You know, you're digging down into the structure. You're reducing that differential between the bottom and the crest of that reef.
Right. Is there, when you look at, like, let's say we stopped it right now, and we stopped the dredging the oyster reefs as it sits right now, how long do you think, what's the recovery time looking like? Is it like thousands of years, hundreds of years, dozens of years?
Well, that's a great question, and I'm not sure it has a factual answer. You know, in the new video we're coming out with, it's stated clearly in there that we got an issue called sea level rise, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a real deal. I mean, I went for years and didn't want to admit it, but the water is getting deeper. You know, and so if if you don't harvest the reef, the natural growth per year will almost keep up with that.
Mm-hmm.
So you can pretty well take that out as a future negative factor in that regard. Ask that question again.
The length of time, the recovery time.
Oh, the recovery time. So I think if we went into the Mesquite Bay Complex, which we have got them to declare that as a sanctuary area, 75,000 acres, that's off limits. They cannot harvest it. If we left it alone, it might heal itself in 50 years. It's a slow process.
Mm-hmm.
It depends upon how bad it had been degraded. You know, if you take a reef that was at the water level and now it's 3 feet deep, you got to fill 3 years. I mean, 3 feet of differential. Yeah. So there's, you know, that's a great question that I just don't think has a great answer.
Yeah, well, sometimes.
But, you know, here's the deal. The objection is, you know, people object, right? They're mm-hmm. going to object. I like to eat oysters. I do too, okay? We have mariculture coming into play, farm-raised mm-hmm. oysters. We have a program called the COL, which is Certificate of Location, where men can come in and lease bottom from the state and create their own reef.
Mm-hmm.
And they have control of that for 15 years, and there's a lot of activity in that arena right now. What we want to do is we want to stop pardon me, the harvest on the public reefs. Not the COL, not the private lease. We want to encourage the mariculture, and I will tell you, I've said this before, that every oyster house that I know of is resourceful enough to go get oysters from somewhere else mm-hmm. and sell them.
Yeah. when you talk about the mariculture, about growing, you know, in the COLs and stuff,
mm-hmm.
is there an opportunity to, on that, let's say that 75,000 acres that's set aside and protected, mm-hmm. could you use, can you do like an artificial stocking, like we do, you know, they stock the bass in the lakes around Lubbock and stuff. Can you do that with oysters and increase your population of oysters and help that, put a Band-Aid on it with farm-raised oysters to make, and then let them, you know, put them out there, don't harvest them, but just, you know, give them a seed, you know, extra seed.
Farm-raised oysters will not reproduce.
Really?
Yes. That's the only way you can legally introduce those into the water.
Is that they won't reproduce.
Yes. So that if they escape, there is no threat to the natural species of oyster. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
There's a program that we're participating in to create, to restore certain reefs in certain locations as nursery reefs for the production of spat for the general dissemination within a bay system.
Mm-hmm.
So the farm-raised oyster is going to be an edible deal.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to, now, there, oddly enough, there's a fallout underneath that escapement, and they go to the bottom, and there will be reefs created, but they will not be, you know, they will give you a base for attachment of the natural spat that's in the water.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you go either way with this answer.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So if you have an artificial reef below a COL, then eventually you could have native species attached to it, and then all of a sudden you've got.
Well, the COL is on the bottom. That's a bottom lease.
Okay.
The oyster farm is a surface lease.
Okay.
You lease the ground underneath it so you can have your oyster baskets above. Everything's grown in baskets.
Yeah. Okay, so, but you're talking about the particulate matter like settling out underneath.
Some will settle out of that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Go to the bottom, and over time, it'll form a reef.
Yeah.
And but so, that reef is not going to, you know, they're not going to be impactful. What I see is a reef is something that is massive. That you go look at our videos and you'll understand what I'm talking about. In the baffle reefs of the Mesquite Bay Complex, they span open water from the barrier islands to the mainland.
Wow. Okay?
Mm-hmm. And to do what I want to do to protect the ecosystem, it's more than a 2-acre deal, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at restoration projects in some of the Mesquite Bay Complex and Carlos Bay right now. We did one that was 70 acres. We got another one that I'm working with a very large corporation in some water offset stuff that could double that easily. So it's time and persistence. And
yeah, well, you're basically talking about the one of the things that holds true through every conservation effort for in wildlife, for, you know, whether it's aquatic mm-hmm. wildlife, avian wildlife, or mammalian wildlife, is the one of the biggest challenges that they tend to face is habitat fragmentation, where you go in and they've had a range that's, and I'm just going to use round numbers, like it's been 1,000 acres. Well, mm-hmm. now it's 750 acres, but the 250 acres that's not in there is scattered all through it, and it breaks it up. And so they don't have, they lose migration routes, they lose, you know, escape cover, they lose the breed nesting cover, you know, and it seems to me like you're working the same thing. When you have the dredging, you break up that reef, and all of a sudden you have new erosion forces on the reef that seems like it reduces, that would cause problems with the oysters. In addition to the original problem you had with the dredging on it, you have, it makes its own series of problems down through it. And then when you go back to fix it, it's got to be fixed in a box big enough to make an impact.
Yes, sir.
So,
well said.
But it's, when you talk about doing a restoration, what goes into the restoration project that you do? What do you do?
Well, it's frustrating in that we have defined in this Mesquite Bay complex, in these five baffle reefs, Carlos, Cedar, third chain, Ayers, and second chain islands, we have defined starting points. You know, you can't look at a project and say, I'm gonna fix all of it. Well, that's just stupid, you know. So we have very specific targets to start. We have one called the Ayers Reef Point, Ayers Point. And to get that done, the first thing you have to do is agree that, you know, between all the agencies that we need to do this. Then you have to do engineering. And from engineering, then you have to do design. And then you have to submit it to all the agencies it's 3 years. You know, and to get started on this $3 million project, you know, $450,000 is for engineering.
Yeah.
You know, so you've got to have a lot. Then you got to have somebody that'll fund it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's a daunting task, but we're working. I mean, the only way you can get any of this done is to start it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not, I said,
whining it about it doesn't do you. Oh, I wish I had the money to do that. Well, hell, go find some.
It's like the way you eat an elephant, one bite at a time.
One bite at a time. That's exactly right. That's one of my favorite lines.
But yeah, you got to start somewhere. When you start, when you look at, when was that 75,000 acres? When was it set aside? When was it protected?
November of 2022.
So very recently, then, relatively speaking, in the world of government, that's yesterday.
Yes, yes. The Parks and Wildlife declared that, and that I just had one of our contemporaries here tell me that in all of the things, you go back to saving the redfish or any of this, what we did in the Mesquite Bay Complex was the greatest conservation accomplishment on Texas coast, period, end of sentence. It set a precedent.
Yeah.
It set a precedent of actually creating a sanctuary.
Yeah.
And a big one.
Yeah, that's not insubstantial. That's a good sized one.
But that took a lot of work. It did. That didn't come easy. It didn't. Anyway.
Well, it's, you know, it's both cautionary and it's also, but it's also heartening that you that it occurred. You know, and that's the thing about it is when somebody starts a battle for conservation and trying to make a change, and when you've got that first flag you can post in the ground, it gives you hope. You know, it gives you hope that there's, hey, we can make some difference on this stuff. We can maybe, like I said, we can maybe stop the down. We can hit it before the tipping point gets here.
Yes.
You know, and we can protect it and we can grow from here on that. And it's, you know, the oyster, you know, the oyster reef issue is one that I've heard about a little bit, but I haven't, you know, it's a long ways from home. And, you know, it's the saying, you know, all politics is local. When it boils back down to it, and when you go, the further we get from the coast, the less we hear about it. The issues that we hear are, you know, playa lakes and, you know, water going away and that kind of stuff. We don't get to hear the stories about, hey, you know, oysters are in danger down here. We need to protect the oysters. And so it's good to be able to get to talk to you about this and learn more about what we can do. What would you give, like, just some random Joe like myself? What would you say, hey, if you want to help, here's how you can help? You know, I'm too far, you know, you're too far away to show up down here on a Saturday on a cleanup or whatever, but what can just the random person do?
Well, for right now, all right, so when we got the sanctuary created, all right, so I came up with this. To get anything done, you have to have a rallying point. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, you can't just go out there and, well, the oysters. Well, what about the oysters? Well, you know, you gotta have a point. And I created the Baffle Reefs. And when I created that, then it was something that everybody could gravitate to. So you have to have a central point. And so from that, I took that concept forward. I had different people come in and say, we can join you in this. And so we ended up with 21 agencies signing a common letter that we submitted to the Parks and Wildlife, and 7,700 individuals did the same thing. So we created a following. And the next move is going to take a following to come in at some point in time. Everybody can't come up there and start jumping up and down and raising a holy hell. You know, it's got to be focused on an objective. The hardest thing in the world to be is a soldier. But to be one in this case, and in a lot of cases, you got to join something, and you got to become knowledgeable in something, and from that you will be prepared to help out when the time comes. I mean, there's enough information that we put out and enough communication that we're doing in social media, both Facebook, Instagram, our notices to our members. But be a member. But, you know, it's $35 a year.
Where's your info? Give me your website and your social media.
Our social media is info@flatsworthy.com. I don't know about.
Google Flatsworthy.
Yeah, it'll Google take you there.
We'll see if we can't hunt it up and find it and make sure we put it in the show notes for us.
Good.
I really appreciate your time. We're running short on time. We got to go to the next thing, and hopefully you get to take a break. And I think this is your third or fourth consecutive interview. So you're
no, that's you know this is all important, and this allows me to move my cause forward, and I appreciate the opportunity. Well, I really do. There's nothing too big or too little in life. You know, when you have a cause you believe in, all of it counts. I've seen it happens time and time again where I might be talking to a person that I don't know from Adam, and in 6 months it comes back to me. You know? So yeah. It's all, I'm going to move this. I want to get this done.
Well, I appreciate the effort that you've given in the past. I appreciate what you're doing now. And I will Google that myself and join your Flatsworthy as soon as this evening when I get done here. But I do want to change, before we shut down,
mm-hmm.
You started fly fishing for redfish and trout in 67, is that what it's?
No, I came to Rockport first time in 67. Bought a house here in 80, moved here full time in 92, started fly fishing in 93.
Okay, so 93, that's still a very long time. So what's your biggest redfish you caught in a fly rod?
17 pounds on a 7-weight.
Oh my God.
Yeah. In the wintertime in deep water, and that sucker fought forever. You know. Go ahead.
What's your biggest trout?
You know what? I'm not a trout fisherman, so I'm going to answer it that way. I don't know what the biggest trout. I just never. Yeah, I love them. I respect them. I'm always after redfish in a foot of water,
mm-hmm.
and that's not the prime habitat for a trout. Big trout.
Yeah.
So I'm not your big trout guy. I'm not.
But a 17-pound redfish on a fly rod is an accomplishment.
Well, yeah. I mean, but it's. It was a fun deal. I don't lie to you, but it's. I don't know. There's the thrill of agony and the burden of defeat or whatever that deal
the
is.
The thrill of victory and the agony.
It's the challenge. You know, it's the whole goal is to go either walk or be in a boat and cover ground and see a fish and then try to catch it.
Yeah.
So
you still get to do it a lot?
No. I'm really working on this nonstop.
Yeah.
There's so many narratives that go on. I have so many different avenues that I need to keep. You know, if I can fish a couple of days a week, that's great.
Yeah.
You know.
If I could fish a couple of days a week, that'd be great.
Yeah.
Someday I'm going to get to fish a couple of days a week. But
well, come down and see me.
I will try to. Yeah. Chuck, I appreciate your time. Thank you very much for being on our show this afternoon. I appreciate it.
Well, I enjoyed it. I appreciate the opportunity and the opportunity of meeting you. I see someone who's really concerned about conservation in your eyes and in your words and in your understanding, and I appreciate
that.
Well, I respect
once
it.
Again, thank you very much for the work you've done. Thank you for what you continue to do and for the inspiration you are to people like me who are just kind of getting into it. Thank
Perfect.
You very much.
Thank you.
Have a good day.